start out, you could tell me who your family is.
Sure. I was born in 45 in Kodiak. And my father, his family originally was from Yuzinki. Anisia Skvortsov my great grandmother. And Wasily was her husband. And she had two daughters, Sarah and Gertrude, they called Galia. And Gertrude married a man by the name of Perry Eaton, my namesake, in about 1915 or 1916. And my father was born in 1918. Perry came from Valdez, where he had settled after the Spanish-American War. He was originally from the Minnesota area, and his family moved into Minnesota from Canada. He had like five brothers, and when the old man died, they sold the farm, literally sold the farm and split the wind. Mm-hmm. He was the only brother that married out of the five. And then he had a couple of sisters. And one of his sisters ended up in Fairbanks running a hotel around 1911. He was in Valdez from 1902 to 1907, and he had a contract to haul mail between Valdez and Fairbanks, the dog team. And he'd take a week up and a week back, and then 2 weeks off, and he ran a machine shop, and then he came to Kodiak in 1907. He was a very successful businessman. He'd been in business with the U.S. Marshal, which was a guy named Carl Armstrong. Carl Jr., and I always thought it was humorous that we as namesakes ended up on a Coniate board together, and our grandfathers had been, his father and my grandfather had been in business together. The family moved out to Seattle in 1950, and then I started coming home and fishing with Dad. Dad would come home every summer and fish. He fished for Halfordy Cannery down there in the channel. And was sort of a protege of a guy named Frank McConaughey. Frank McConaughey was sort of my first godhead idol, cannery superintendent, really, really powerful man, made decisions about everybody's life in those days. Always wanted to be a cannery superintendent. I always thought that was cool, and you know, the culture is so fascinating because up until the breaking up of the real syndicates, you went to a cannery in any remote location. The superintendent lived in a White House. That was the name. He lived in the White House, like Larson Bay. Segregated dining rooms, where the elite ate in a blue room, and actually had these segregation kinds of things. It wasn't so much along race lines as it was power and economics. And if you were the cannery superintendent, you were incredibly powerful. Every cannery superintendent sort of had a nickname by the fishermen. And Kadiak Fisheries over here in the 50s and 60s was run by a guy named Chuck Turner. And he was pretty dictatorial, and they called him Lord Turner. And he would he'd actually tell a fisherman where to fish, and if you didn't do what he told you to do, he just wouldn't send a tender there to pick up your fish. Mm-hmm. Tremendously powerful. Who got what boat? Who got the grub at the end of the season and how it was divided. And Frank McConaughey was known as Whispering Jesus. I mean, all these power trips. And that's sort of what I was wanted to do. And I grew up in Seattle, went to school K through 12 in the Seattle area, and fished every year. And then when I went to college, Dad didn't want me to go to college. But it was a total, complete waste of time. But it was interesting, he sent my sisters to college because he thought that was a very good place for a woman to find a husband. It was college. But it wasn't about education at all. Mm-hmm. It was more a social thing. So I always tease people and say my older sister was an older child. She got braces in a college and I got $10 for graduation from high school. But Dad and I were very close. He became very, very involved with land claims early on. Mm-hmm. And it was really important to him, not so much from a cultural standpoint, and the cultural awakening that we enjoy today, and sort of the reawakening of the people and the identity was, yeah, that was something, but he wasn't into that. He was was into the correctness of getting back what was stolen from us. Mm-hmm. And he felt that the land had always been stolen. And I think it goes back to the days when he had a piece of land that was a home site, 5-acre home site, out by the city dump. T.T. Jackson Trailer Park out there. Mm-hmm. Well, we had a 5-acre piece there. He filed a home site in 1939, I think. He could never get title to it. They just kept running around and around and around and around. So when we moved to the States in 1950, he walked away from it. Mm-hmm. He gave his interest to T.T. Jackson for, I think, $500. But it wasn't a clear title, and he was off the government. So when land claims came around, he got very, very, very involved. Mm-hmm. I had served an apprenticeship in Seattle, had been working for Boeing as a machinist, and got very bored with that. I was going to school and working nights. So I had a good friend who was a rabbi. And I asked him one day what I should do. And I'd been interviewing with Cannon, who's trying to get on again. And he said that if I'd been a good Jew boy, that it put me in finance. He says, finance is like standing on the end of a diving board in a pool. You're dressed for whatever you're going to hit when you step off. So he actually got me a job at a bank. So I worked, became a banker actually. And started working very young and collecting delinquent debts. Installment credit debts, and worked my way up, and then came home in 1971 and was working for First National Bank of Anchorage as an officer. And then I left there as an assistant vice president and went to work for the Alaska Native Foundation, which at that time was working with implementation issues, heavily funded by Ford Foundation. Worked there for a couple of years and then went over to United Bank Alaska, which was the native bank. And was a vice president there in charge of marketing and development. Stayed there until 1981 and then moved over and became the head of something called Community Enterprise Development Corporation, CEDC. And it was one of President Johnson's War on Poverty programs. And stayed there 17 years and ran that. And then left there to put together the Native Heritage Center. And sort of went over there, took the project, and kind of brought it out of chaos, put it on track, got it open on time, under budget. Damn it, killed me. And got really brutalized in politics and got the hell out. And then I was recruited by Alaska Pipeline to come over and straighten out the Native relations along the corridor. So I did that for a couple of years, and then they promoted me or demoted me, perhaps, and I became the head of personnel HR a couple of years ago. And I'm just straightening out the department. I've been done with that another year. Mm-hmm. And then I'll leave that position, at least. Maybe not the company. Mm-hmm. I've been involved in a lot of financing activities. Was the chairman of the board of Alaska Housing Finance, Alaska Renewable Resources, Blue Cross of Washington, Alaska, co-chair of the Federal State Commission on Policies and Programs Affecting Alaska Natives. I think I've served on about 47 boards of directors. Was on the board of directors of Coney, the original board, first board. Got sued in the litigation over merger. Sort of got out of that. Just too tough, I'm not that strong. Mm-hmm. The politics was particularly good. Mm-hmm. So, sort of kicked around a lot. Was interesting in college. I was an art major. And the business just sort of was a minor. I had to take a lot of business classes and things. And the banking just sort of segregated.
Mm-hmm. So, Perry, can you share with me a little bit growing up in Seattle? And knowing that you're from Kodiak and having that sense of identity, can you talk to me, especially since you went through and you were heavily involved in Anscombe and Noble, can you explain to me a little bit of maybe the identity, some people point an identity crisis that you've had as a Native person, sure. especially Aleutic in an area that's so westernized.
Sure. Remember the very first time I got in a situation that Alaska became a focal point. I was in the 8th grade and we were studying geography, and Alaska was what we were studying. And we had one of those teachers, what do you call them when they're serving their apprenticeship?
Student teacher.
Student teacher came in, had graduated from college, and she was teaching, a very nice lady. And so she was teaching this class about Alaska. And she had approached it, what I've learned later was very stereotypical. The Eskimos, the ice, the walruses in the mountains, and the bleakness and everything. And of course, I knew that was not correct. And I told her, and I got hauled down to the principal's office. And I don't think I was terribly diplomatic in telling her that she didn't know what the hell she was talking about. Probably I used those words. Mm-hmm. But I got very emotional, very upset about it. And I remember she got upset. Not mad, but she was upset because in some way she was not communicating with her students. So I'm sure it left a lasting impression on her. But the thing for me was that Kodiak was so different than the culture in the States, and yet it was so much the same. And my grandmother had gone to Seattle to convalesce for a brain surgery in the 1920s, and my grandfather, Perry Eaton, had died, and she had remarried, and she lived there. With her sister, Sarah. I'd come home in the fall or whatever, and so I'd be running around grandma's, and so I'd be using like native words, like tumalak, like the humpy fish. And she'd get really upset, and she would say that, she'd chide me. She'd say, that's long ago, that's not us. We're not that. We don't use those words. And she discouraged that in her house very much. She had married white. Perry Eaton was non-native, and later her second husband, Chester Hicks, was non-native, and she was extremely sensitive about being native. And she did everything she could to kind of discourage any kind of identity. I always thought that was kind of strange, never really dampened my view of things. But it taught me there were two worlds. And I remember stories of my mother riding between, and she was non-native, riding a tender between Kodiak and Mzinki, an old boat called the Oregon Wolf that belonged to Grimes, Oscar Grimes. And there was a woman on board that's still alive and left unnamed, but she was berating another woman because this other woman had married a native man. And she was berating her because her kids were going to be native. And she had married a white man, and her kids were going to be white. And real interesting lines kind of drawn. I remember when I was about 15 or 16 and becoming quite infatuated with the opposite sex. 4th of July was a huge thing in Kodiak. Everybody came. And the girls came in from Old Harbor, and I remember a girl climbing up the ladder and getting in, and she was wearing nylons, and but she had not shaved her legs. And the boys were making big joke. And old lady Heitman, Gus Heitman's mom, was behind me on the dock, and I made some offhand comment. And she cuffed me. She hit me right on my ear. And I turned around, and she said, you're one of us, too. And she was mad, just livid mad. And so, it slowly was made aware. And our family was a family that had crossed. We had definitely crossed. And we were very accepted in all the native homes and all our relatives in Mzinki, but nobody ever said anything publicly. We would never do that. So if you wanted to identify with your cousins and stuff, and you wanted to play with them, and you wanted to be part of them, that was fine. But if you wanted to be aloof, that was okay too. And nobody sort of infringed on your having crossed. But up until the 1950s, the race, particularly the crossing issue, was one that people really respected among each other. And you might make a comment about somebody, but it was always an inside joke with insiders, and you never, ever, ever shared it with outsiders. Never, ever. So it was really, really an interesting situation. Land claims in Kodiak made people stand up. It was your moment to testify. Were you a convert or weren't you? Did you believe? Didn't you believe? And of course, the money and the activity and the fervor of the moment and the expectation of the moment brought everybody out of the woodwork. There was a lot of criticism about, oh yeah, you know, for two generations I haven't said a damn word. Now all of a sudden, man, you're chimney every time you see me, kind of stuff. And it never bothered me because I knew that this was a turning point. Once you're on the list, you're on the list. I remember Dad and I had a talk about it, and we talked about the Jewish community during the Second World War and how it was easy for the Nazis to round up the Jews because they were on the list. And there was a real discussion about whether you really wanted to be on the list or not. Did you really want to be anonymous, or did you want to be listed? Did you want to stigmatize your children? And it was a serious discussion. I think a lot of families had it in one form or another. Poor lives of farming people, a lot of them had crossed. There had been a lot of intermarrying, and there was no real stigmatization on the North End much at all. If you were different, it was because you were Russian. Everybody was Russian, and it was a good safe thing to be. And the Native piece wasn't discussed that much. There was one man in my life who was Native before it was popular at all, a guy named Charlie Christopherson. Annie and Emil Christopherson, oldest boy, Andy Christopherson's uncle. Mm. And he was a crazy guy, fun guy. He was a web boss for Halperty. He was very, very, very strong, very tough guy. Was a Golden Gloves boxing champion during the war. So he took on anybody in the military that was on the base. He fought them if they wanted to fight. And he went so far as to sign his Christmas cards. And Christmas cards were very big in the 50s. It was nothing to get 300 Christmas cards. And there came a point when you could order your cards and have them pre-printed with your name. And Charlie had his printed the Savage. Caused all kinds of, you know, craziness. But he'd come along, and you'd be sitting on the bull rail at the dock, and he'd come along in his coveralls, and he'd just walk up and punch you in the shoulder. It was a short jab, and he could punch. It, you know, it hurt. And he'd say, "That hurt? How come that don't hurt?" "Because I'm Elliot." "That's good." If you didn't answer right, you got another one. But he was very, very cognizant of his pride. He was the very first person that I ever knew that carried the dignity that we see today. Very important guy. Very important guy. He used to bunk with us. He'd come down to the States and he'd stay at the house during the night. Cool guy. Cool guy.
So can you explain a little bit more after land claims that happened? Have you notice this issue of crossing that has surfaced? You know, before you mentioned, before land claims, it was okay to cross, and right, people would just accept it if you had decided to be non-Native or if you decided to be Native. After land claims, can you kind of explain a little bit about how that might have changed that sense of crossing or acceptance of it?
You know, it's been 30 years, and probably the first 5 years were pretty heady times. The expectation was huge. I mean, Land Clearings was going to solve every social problem that had ever been there. It was going to take care of the economics forever. And everybody was going to be rich. And as the reality would set in, and the sort of the reality of corporate world, I don't think anybody was ready to play corporate games. And people settled back into kind of a pattern. And from about 75, 76 area, people, there were some people that kind of soured, and not everybody could play. There was only so many directors. The Village Corporation sort of came into their own. And then there was a strong effort to merge everything on the island. And the merger polarized the families, the villages, litigation that followed. And we went through almost 7 years of litigation. And the litigation destroyed a lot of our natural leadership. The best of the best sort of came forward and were out in front. They got their legs chopped up. The people settled into sort of a new identity. And it was forced on the community by, not by virtue of the native community, by virtue of the non-native community. And all of a sudden, these arrogant upstarts, the natives who now own everything, are having problems. And the told you so's and folks sort of came forward, and the native community began to sort of bond together in a common kind of a cause, and not necessarily defending the actions of the individuals and the corporations, but just quietly forming a sense of solidarity. That reaction to the non-native reaction really, in my mind, began the rebirth of the re-identity of the people. Well, if I'm a native, what does that mean? People started actually asking the question, do I have to eat those foods I don't like? People would say words, and language became somewhat important, but people would correct each other when they would use words. And then you started to see just a lot more native community. There were more gatherings. The function after the official function of the corporation became a native function. And it began to take on almost a life of its own. People that didn't want to play, that were native, didn't want to play, were never ostracized. You were never looked down on for not to, in fact, if there was any ostracism, came as a result of wanting to be too much. And some people really got excited about it. You know, the stimulus to be affiliated is a very, very strong drive in the human being. And here was an identity that had power. The land, for the very first time, somebody could stand up at the national park. People talked back with federal policy, pushed back statewide, never heard of before. Governors would call and want you on the boards, want to know what you were thinking, solicited your opinions. Didn't always follow, but you went from being something of a pariah collectively to a collective identity that was sought out to have things discussed with you. And that was really new. By the middle 80s, into the 80s, it was a given. It was no longer an oddity. When I sat on a board of directors, people didn't go, yeah, it's pretty good. And it's native too. People just accepted you as a native voice. And that was nice, really nice. But it also brought a certain amount of responsibility. If you said something, people thought it was gospel.
Well, the native said.
What do you mean the native said?
Well, Perry Eaton said.
And there was this sort of collectivization of a concept that all natives were unified. And that, you know, when the Arctic Slope opposed something, that meant all natives were against it. When the Sea of Alaska wanted something, that meant all natives wanted it. And the press had a hard time with that. They'd run huge headlines. Natives moved to acquire beluga coal fields. It was serious cocaine. It was a corporation. It had nothing to do with the natives. And we still suffer some of that stigma today. But it's better. You'll see headlines now that Chilista signs a bird migratory agreement or something, which means it's really a delta issue, not a statewide issue. But crossing and recrossing, I don't know of any real stigma today. You can sort of be wherever you want to be and not suffer one way or the other. There might be a clicker of tongue here or there, but it's not near the social stigma that it used to be.
Well, if it's okay with you, I'd like to kind of switch gears now and maybe talk with you a little bit. I know that you started carving masks, so I was wondering if maybe you could share a little bit about what motivated you to begin carving masks and kind of the process that you went through to start doing that.
Well, I'm an artist, and I've been very, very heavily involved in photography for the last 15, 20 years. I painted when I was in college and some of my early married life, but then I switched over kind of to photography as a real outlet. And I had international exhibits and stuff. And then I've always been fascinated by masks, really fascinated. But there's so little out there. And the Pinard collection, the large collection of Cognac masks in France, really became accessible to the public about 10 years ago. And there's been a dissertation written and a number of stuff. So then I wanted to see the masks. And I had carved some stuff, but mostly out of stylized approaches. And so I went to France to see the collection. And the collection really got me motivated, in part because I thought that it was totally misunderstood. At least half of the collection, in my opinion, are replicas that were commissioned by Pinard, by about four different artists. And then there's a collection of what I call the old masks. And for all the education and learning and everything, the anthropologists couldn't see that because they weren't carved. But you can walk in the room if you've ever carved a mask. I mean, it's real obvious, just terribly obvious. And so then Sven Jr. Fish and I have been pretty close during his education. And so he and I sort of kind of got to talking about that. And so I did a couple for myself, just because I wanted to do it. And I got some dang much satisfaction out of it. And it really tweaked my interest. So I really started digging in. And so I'm trying to accumulate a photo of every existing mask, which aren't that many, maybe a couple hundred, not much more than that. And someday I'd like to write a book about it. But I just get a tremendous amount of personal satisfaction. For me, it's a celebration. And a lot of us, you know, we talk about our history, and a lot of it's negative. A lot of it's what other people did to us. It's what the Russians did to us. It's what the Americans did to us. It's what the school teachers did to us. It's what the missionaries did to us. I'm really tired of being a victim. I just don't have time for it anymore at all. It's interesting stories. It's part of our history, and we need to understand it. But it's time we backed off and started celebrating some of the great beauty of our own culture. So the masks for me are a real celebration. So I get a hoot out of it. And I'm finding a lot of people are more interested in it than I'd ever imagined. I love to see my masks dance. That's sort of the ultimate thing, is to see Kenneth Mitchell dancing in front of your mask. So that's really cool.
During the week, you kind of shared a little bit about your different techniques in mask carving, and I was particularly intrigued by how some would say you're very perfectionist in the way that you produce masks. Can you kind of describe a little bit of your technique or the fact that you always carve it so it's danceable, those types of things?
Well, the mask is an artifact in the sense that it's a piece of the culture. And it only stands alone when it's out of its culture. And by that I mean most people make masks and they hang them on the wall. And that's very good. And what that is a piece of Western art, which is great. You know, I really encourage it. But it's not a Koniag mask. Because a Koniag mask is a piece or a paraphernalia to a dance. And if you can't use it, it's sort of like a spoon without a bowl. If it won't hold soup, it's not a spoon. Well, if you can't dance the mask, if you can't put a string on it, tie it to your face, it's not a spoon. It's a piece of artwork. And there are some beautiful pieces of artwork, and I don't want to discourage anybody from ever making art along the motif of masks. But for me, it has to live. In order to live, it has to dance or be able to be danced. So it's sort of just a personal rule with me I make my masks in a manner in which they can be danced. Now, not all of them have strings on them, but they all can have strings put on them and you can wear them and you can dance them. They all have eyes, they all have noses, and most of them have an open mouth. Some masks, even in the old days, did not have an open mouth. But to me, that gives it life. And if you draw the eyes on, or draw the nose on, or draw the mouth on, then it really has no life. So I don't pretend to suggest that that's some mythical piece of the culture. It's just my personal sort of rules that I've set out for myself. And it gives me a great amount of satisfaction. The last thing I do to a mask before I paint it is carve the eyes in. And when the eyes open on the mask, it becomes... And I have to be careful what you say. You know, you don't want to say that it becomes alive or it's got a spirit. But in a way, that's true. It really is. The thing becomes something other than a block of wood. I also carve large masks in the tradition of the old masks that I've researched. There are a bunch of masks that are very small, about so big. I believe those were commissioned in their replicas, or they're patterned after. Not to say they're copies and that they are not Koniag masks, which they certainly are. But I think that they're a huge piece of Kennard's collection that he actually had made here at the Fogg in the 1870s. So I try and make the large mask, a lot of depth, not a flat mask. You know, the 2x4 stock that can only be this thick, I have a real problem with. I want blocks of wood that I can work with, or I'll actually laminate. I'll actually put two or three pieces together, clamp them in, glue them in real, real tight, and use that block of wood to carve. But it has to have the depth. And when I was in France and I had a chance to look at the masks, none of them are flat. They all have a lot of depth and perspective to them. But it gives me just a tremendous amount of pleasure. I've donated some of my masks to charities that have auctioned them off, and it's almost obscene how much money people pay for them. I mean, you sort of kind of put your head down and you go, I'd never pay that. I wouldn't do that, man. You're crazy. But I think that from a socioeconomic standpoint, the guys in the village and you need to be more of a craftsman than an artist. But really well-crafted masks bring thousands of dollars.
Do you feel that since you've started mask carving, well, I have a couple of questions. I better ask them now before I forget them so that we can both remember them. My first question is, do you feel that since you've started carving masks, then that has affected your identity or your sense of identity as an Inuit person? And my second question is, I know that, especially with the elders, there's a sense of, some of them have a stigma or a sense of, you'll have difficulty with the idea of masks, and I'm sure you face that, and how have you addressed that difficulty?
Two good questions. Does it give me a greater settling about my identity? Yes and no. I mean, I'm reasonably comfortable with who I am. I had some struggles early on when I was 19, 20 years old in there. I had two sets of values and I didn't understand either set. While it doesn't, it doesn't hurt in the sense of grounding you, but any good therapeutic sense of production will do fundamentally the same thing. I mean, hobbies, that's what hobbies are all about, is giving you a sense of center. I don't consider it a hobby at all. I sort of take offense when people say, well, that's your hobby. No, it's more than that. It's more than that. It's sort of like saying, well, I paint icons on weekends and that's my hobby. No, it's not that. But you're right about some of the old people. We have been taught that a lot of artifacts, particularly our recognizable art. I mean, it's okay to pick up an old Lulu, but if you pick up a stone lamp and it has a pecked face in it, that's, borders on the graven image, Christianity, the pseudo-fear. I think that some of our masks, the shaman and we had secret cults, the whaling cults, and there were a lot of taboos around the spears and the tools and what was used in the hunt. And I think some of our masks that were kept in the caves and were used in multiple ceremonies certainly had religious connotations about them, and spiritualism, heavy spiritualism around them. But today's fear, I think, centers around the Christian doctrine of graven images and the fear of the Christian church and being undermined by paganism. And we were just taught that that's really bad, in the same way we were taught Jews were bad people. And it's just part of the teachings of the church, it's part of safeguarding the purity of the belief. When I take time to share what I know about the masks, what I've read, even the conflicting stories, and when you put up a demonstration or a display of a mask, a lot of our masks are just plain goofy masks. They make you laugh. And I totally believe that many of our masks were used for pure entertainment. And they are pretty, and they are nice pieces of art, and they are funny. Some of them make you laugh. I try very hard when I talk about them to demystify them. Some people venerate the mask as though it was some kind of a magical thing, and I don't believe that. I believe they have life, but I don't necessarily believe it's an evil or some kind of a supernatural hoop-de-doo. So I try and bring them down, and I try and show them in context. And people seem to get comfortable with them. We had that in this weekend, or this last week, we had people say, ooh, I didn't like this in the beginning, but after I look at it, it doesn't affect me the same way.
When you were talking about, just a minute ago, about the mask being more than just a hobby, I think maybe subliminally or not, you compared it to icon painting. So do you view your cognitive mass almost on a spiritual level? Or can you kind of explain a little bit more on that? Perhaps you don't want to.
That's real dangerous ground. People have a lot of problem with it. And I'm not sure I understand it myself. I'm Russian Orthodox. I do believe in icons. And if you can get there, you're well on your way to appreciating a spiritual nature in almost everything. I often think back and think about the priests when they must have first come. The conversion here must have been very easy. I mean, here is a religion that believes in a single God, that has a son, that is celebrated in a ceremony that includes smoke and vestments, and has objects. Duh. I mean, it's just a real fine line. You know, and I think in many cases, did the shaman have a prettier robe than the priest? No. Did he chant as well? Maybe, maybe not. But you take a look at the ritual of the Orthodox Church, and it has all of the rhythms of an indigenous religion. And it has many, many, many of the same concepts. If you have a quiver of arrows that can't be observed by women, that's holy in its own sense, and it's sacred, you can't foul it. And I mean, it's just a little tiny leap. A candle vigil, it's candle, is just that far away, and the incense and the chanting, they're close. They really are. Not a big gap. And if the priest has got medicine, he puts the shaman down every time.
Well, if you were going to look back on any advice that you ever received from an elder, what would stick out as one of the most valuable pieces of advice, or the funniest, or something that you really, really remember?
I laugh about Dad was not the only one, most of the men. They used to say men rule and women decide. And when you think about it, it's a very, very equal division of human activity. And neither one can stand without the other. It's a real yin and yang. And as particularly America has struggled with gender equality, it always makes me laugh that we had it figured out, or a system that worked way, way in advance. The other piece of advice that I was given was not so much cultural as it was just plain important, and that was to learn to write. Not read, but write. If you can't write, you can't go anywhere. And so in particularly college-bound, high school-bound kids, whenever I talk to them, that's always the advice I give, is learn to write. Learn to write. You can't write when you're grown. You just ain't gonna make it.
Well, Clay Anderson, thank you very much for your time, Perry.
Sure.